RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Professor Grant Schofield is the founder of the Future of Medicine Movement, Chief Science Officer at Precure, Professor of Public Health and Director of the Human Potential Centre at Auckland University of Technology, and former Chief Scientific Advisor to New Zealand's Ministry of Education. Professor Schofield's dedication to unlocking human potential and driving positive change in healthcare has made him a prolific author and a sought-after influencer. And he joins us now here at RCR to talk mainly about the state of mental health, the investment in it, and what can be done to improve it, like stuff that really works. Hi, Grant. Thanks for coming back on RCR.
Paul, so fabulous to be back on an actual RCR, fully up and on the air. So congratulations, such an important part of the New Zealand media landscape. So thank you for getting back up.
Well, thank you for saying that. And just thanks to our supporters, because without them, that's the magic bit, we wouldn't be here. Anyway, quite a few things to get through. First up, I'm curious about the New Zealand General Practice Conference that I think you presented at, Glenn Davies presented at, and we'll talk to Glenn about that when he's on next. So tell us what happened there, because are we at a kind of tipping point here at the moment?
This is a fabulous thing that's actually just happened. So there's two versions of the New Zealand General Practitioners Conference, which is this sort of annual massive big conference where they get most of their medical education and that sort of keeping up to date stuff that they do. So Dr. Peter Chapman, who really convenes that whole thing, has been keen, and he did this. We've done the Rotorua version. Dr. Glenn Davies and I got up and spoke about in the main auditorium in place of Shane Retty, who didn't turn up. And so we're able to put the session in there. And then with Professor Nikki Turner, who's sort of been, I suppose, on the other side of all this as far as the COVID response was concerned. So we got to really talk openly, without prejudice, and clearly and coherently, I think, for the first time in New Zealand medicine about, you know, what we got wrong, which was a lot. And so we're able to talk about that. And so I think that's a good thing. And then Simon Thornley actually is joining us in Christchurch in August to do the same down there.
Two things. Why didn't Retty turn up? Something else came up, maybe?
I don't know the reason for that, but that's just politics, I suppose.
And how did that go down, Grant?
Pretty good. And you know, this, I think, you know, in this community particularly, we're all aware of a lot of the harms, either through the mandates or, you know, vaccine harm that was perpetrated through that whole process. And you know, people in medicine they weren't all singing off that page, and a lot of them were silenced. And, you know, the ability to operate as a health professional where you were getting informed consent, not coercing people, you know, being able to understand data and present it on your own terms, all things central to medicine, you know, were overridden. I think there's a widespread agreement now that there were some real wrongs there, the way the medical council acted. My particular presentation, I started with my own stories of the harms in my family, just to contextualise those and the wider society that I work in. And then I sort of took a fairly strong legal framework around, you know, where we went wrong around, you know, informed consent and the mandates, the presenting of data in an unethical way when the original trial, 42,000 people only had 10 severe cases of COVID to make a judgment on that, and talking about 95% effective where, you know, the absolute risk difference was, you know, in the thousandths of 1%. The data around uni students and adolescents around, you know, that it's pretty clear there was many times more harm than benefit from any of these vaccines, and mandating them was unethical, through to the Public Health Act and how that the legal framework that was supposed to operate in, where the Director General is given a mandate free of political interference, and clearly that didn't happen at all. And we now know that the Ministry of Health and Ashley Bloomfield didn't advise on mandates; they advised against them, but Cabinet went ahead with that anyway. That's a breach. And then just our Bill of Rights and being able to consent to a medical procedure. So there's, I concentrated on those things, but yeah, there's many other things to get into, and it's, you know, it's quite a hard space to get into with GPs, because you don't want to get into every last biological plausible pathway. I think probably in my case, I wanted to concentrate on the legal stuff.
Okay. Many of us have kind of anecdotal impressions of the consequences of what happened. I mean, you mentioned family members, there's some in my family too. Mm. Did you get an idea, back channel or on the sidelines from GPs relating their experiences? And
yeah.
And what did they say? No, obviously, no names, no identification, but they must be seeing this presenting to them.
Yeah, I think there's a pretty widespread view of we got a lot of stuff wrong there. The political layer was certainly, you know, in hindsight, it's just crazy. And, you know, many would say obscene. And I think there's a widespread thing. And saying that, you know, I think you would say it's probably an evenly split field now rather than the 90%, 10%. So, but it's not a revolution of the whole thing.
And Nikki Turner, I'm curious about what she had to say, because I've seen what she said before.
Yeah, I think it's like, oh, yeah, mistakes were made and we shouldn't have mandated. So that's interesting that she said that, but still, you know, very much down the track of safe and effective, nothing to see here. And I'm not sure about that. So I think that's going to remain the party line on that side. But I think, you know, even for that group to say, actually, we should never have mandated these procedures, I think we take that as a win and a move forward, frankly.
Yeah, I think I agree. Yeah. All right, let's get on, if there's not any more to report back on that, let's get on to mental health, lack of investment. Is mental health in a worse state than it's ever been, and if so, why? Because even though we've had our tribulations, you know, life's kind of not that hard compared to how it used to be. So you'd think that would assuage, you know, anxiety and all those things. What is the picture out there at the moment?
Yeah, really? I mean, you make such a good point, and it's an interesting thing. You know, I'm not saying we want this for our country. We aspire to be, you know, have a good standard of living and not, you know, having civil war break out. But, you know, in places where those things happen, mental health isn't a problem at all because you've got more to worry about. You're right. So that's probably not a solution. And you're right, we've also probably got it the best we've ever had it as a species in New Zealand, and as far as everything's concerned. So how do you reconcile that with the fact that I think our young people is probably the most interesting age group? And I talk about the statistic a lot. So the New Zealand Health Survey, psychological distress, not illness, just not coping well. So the severe psychological distress is measured in our population really robustly all the time. And in 2005, for the 16 to 24-year-olds, it was about 5.6%. Girls usually twice as bad as boys on every measure except for suicides. So that's well known. That was tripping along quite evenly until about 2010 and 11, and then it inflected upwards and continued, and it still is accelerating, especially for that age group. So in 2021, it was about 24% of our young people, up from 5.6%. Severe psychological distress, so not coping with day-to-day life. And you're right, you go, well, how the hell can that be? It's not that bad. And yeah, there's some social gradient stuff and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, a big argument, and it's been pretty popular actually in sort of popular science writing. So Jonathan of Haidt's The Anxious Generation has just come out. There's another one called Bad Therapy. There's reflects back on Haidt's earlier work in 2019, the coddling of the American mind, a sort of safetyism, he puts it, but an avoidance of uncomfortableness. And my argument really is that actually the major problem is a sort of lack of physical and psychological robustness, because we're kept safe, both physically, you know, that sort of free-range playing and that which makes up a good childhood and life has disappeared. It's hard to get the data on New Zealand kids, but American boys, 8 hours a day on screens, American girls, 7 hours a day. You know, these are things that didn't exist a few generations ago.
Is that why 2010 is a kind of significant timestamp.
Yeah, that's the argument that was mobile phones and then social media, and that's just accelerated since. So my expectation is that we'll be in worse mental health shape in the next few years as well, because they're only getting more pervasive. And there's I don't deviate too much, Paul, but there's some such interesting things also happening with that generation. They're reading way less, so you know, fewer than 10% will read for pleasure, down from 70% in the 70s.
That's interesting. What does that mean? Because I mean, I used to read quite a bit as a kid. I don't read so much now because people can tell me, even talking books. In fact, I listened to 1984 all over again, you know, bedtime for about the last few weeks and months ago, and it was so easy to do.
Well, I suppose that's still reading, though, right? You're still creating that world in your mind.
Well, yeah, and that was what I was going to ask, because it does do just that, and that must be a process that is more expansive than not engaging in that, I'm thinking.
Yeah, and actually, since you're on 1984, you could probably read his contemporary's hypothesis, which was Huxley's A Brave New World, which says actually we're not going to have need the thought police. We'll actually be bathing in such tepidity of passive incoming data that we will forget how to think, and that'll be the problem with humanity. And this was in the 1920s with silent movies, and
yeah,
he was lamenting the fact we didn't have debates at weddings anymore, you know, let alone Netflix. So yeah, that's probably the reading's the thing. The other thing for that age group is sex. You know, they're not having sex like we used to. And that's a really interesting thing for us. It's like, you know, of being of that age group at one time, I did think about that a fair bit at the time. That seems to be a thing. And there's a whole sort of biological cascade around that as well, and what that means for society and, you know, sort of traditionally conservative society and that sort of thing, as well as you've just got sort of brain neurochemistry that doesn't respond the same way to sex because of it's been overwhelmed by.
I would have thought that was one of the most powerful drivers that we could have.
Yeah, well, I think when you're on mobile devices a lot, you're vaping, you've got porn, you've got social media, you've got gaming, then this whole you've got junk food, then this neurotransmitter dopamine goes way up, gets down regulated now, so it doesn't work properly. And when that doesn't work properly, the whole oxytocin system, which is sort of that bonding really high in sex, is also impaired. So you're just not getting the normal biology of all this just fails to work when you sit on a device all the time. And so that's another whole factor. So you've just got all these multiple factors affecting young people, especially mental health, but it affects all of us. And we're not talking about it. It's not really something that we're investing in, thinking about. You know, our solution in this country is more counselling. It's not the cause, and it's not the solution.
Mollycoddling approach.
Yeah. Avoid. Yeah. And the classic psychological therapy in this case, cognitive behavioural therapy, is avoid the triggers that avoid you thinking badly. And it's like, oh gosh, I would take the exact opposite approach.
Yeah. Yeah, because how do you know which way's up in the end?
Yeah, well, that's right. You need stress. And you know, in the behavioural end, the other thing that I think people might be interested in, well, at least I think this is a problem in this country, Paul, is there's a sort of the political left argues against doing anything behavioural to help your health, because it's all social determinants. It's like the poor, based on race, whatever. And they have a point, because those groups are marginalised and do worse, but eventually it comes down to changing your behaviour. But, you know, you can imagine how useless this would have been for stopping smoking in the 60s and 70s. Like, look, we've got to sort out poverty before we do anything about getting people to stop smoking, because it's all related to poverty. You know, you'd be paralysed and you'd do nothing about public health as occurs in smoking. And that's essentially is what's happening in public health in this country now. We're paralyzed into inaction by our fear of social inequalities. And that might seem like a really small thing, or a petty thing, or a weird thing for a professor of public health to be saying, but I think it's important. So we're not able to talk about getting active, getting outside, getting off your device, getting a better night's sleep, making friends, because, you know, we're worried about these other social factors, which by and large the health system can't control.
I'm just thinking, and this might be a very controversial thing for me to ask you, but, you know, and we've been reminded of it this past week with Jacinda back with her kindness and empathy again. Yeah. And that all sounds great on the surface, and it was a great selling tool during the period that we were talking about before. But is this the result, how do I say this kindly, of, well, fourth wave feminism and this perception of male toxicity and wanting to protect the world from that and having these, well, I don't know if they're unintended consequences, but these consequences, because something's driving it, right? Something's driving it.
Yeah, I think there's a bigger picture, which I call safetyism, or Jonathan Haidt called the coddling of the American mind, so we'll call it the coddling of the Kiwi mind here, is that we're just, you know, there's a fear of robust debate. There's a fear of offence. There's a fear of everything, and you dress that up with the opposite. Oh, it's nothing but kindness. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the great irony of Ardern's tyranny, if I can put it that way, is that you often end up with the exact opposite of that, right? So all this kindness and empathy turned out to be anything but. And, you know, that's the great interesting thing about, you know, RCR and robust debate and disagreement with each other and going, no, that's all bullshit. It might be difficult on the surface, but in the end, it ends up with better relationships and kindness and people understanding each other's point of view. So it's such a paradox of life, isn't it?
But that's dangerous if you want to, in a tyrannical way, control everyone.
Yeah, that's right. So there's always that view that there's a sort of, yeah, I don't know about the tyranny of it all. I mean, I used that word myself, didn't I? Gosh. But the, you know, maybe it's just a basic, you know, some ideology with basic incompetence is what you actually end up getting that. And
okay, I hope it's that.
End up, yeah.
I really do hope it's incompetence. I never thought I'd say that, but I really hope it is.
Yeah. Well, I used the word as well, so who knows?
Yeah. Well, the thing is what to do about it, because where does this road take us if it carries on?
Yeah, there's. I feel in the mental health space and the robustness space, which is really my main thing, is that, you know, if you're a parent or an adult in society, like, you really just got to have a good look at the, you know, what role you're playing in this. And, you know, your kids are going to have to be exposed to things that they feel very uncomfortable with, and some of them will upset them. And I'm not saying you seek out to go and do that, but it's the only way of building robust humans is to be exposed to a variety of points of view, you know, to be physically and cognitively out of your zone a lot of the time, and to figure your way through that that world that's always throwing that stuff at you in a way. If you can't help your kids do that, then you're not getting parenting 101 in any way, shape or form right, in my opinion. Now, I know that's not a very palatable message, but I think that's got some truth in it.
There are some efforts, though, it seems, you know, I don't know who from, to kind of disconnect parents from their kids in a way. We've seen that with the transgender and all of that. The sort of, direct parental replacement sort of way of doing things where the state potentially becomes the parent and tells the parent what to do. That seems to be a thing now.
Yeah, I don't think that's ever worked out that well in human history, so I'm not sure why it would be any good now. That's all I would say about it. So
yeah, but that's what you got to push back against. So parents, but everyone's time poor as well, Grant. That's the problem. It's easy to let someone, you know, the kid languish away on a device because you're not going to hear from them. They're not going to cause you any problems. You don't have to.
That's true. They're a good babysitter.
But, you know, it used to be the TV, but at least you're in the same room with them then.
Yeah. I mean, the one untruth of that, you go time poor, that's perceived at least. I mean, the reality is that the amount of time that adults spend passively on devices as well is an extraordinary replacement for how we've lived in the past.
Yeah, good point.
I mean, I'd challenge people to do a 40-hour famine of a device, you know, just completely put this thing away for 40 hours and see how much your life would change.
I went out to the gas station the other day and then to the supermarket, and I realized I'd left my phone at home, and I had this nagging feeling.
Anxiety?
And then I thought, hey, stop just a moment, boy. It's only you're just going to do a few chores. You don't need to be attached to this thing. But that was my sort of unthought through reaction.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be interesting. That's such a – I mean, we all find ourselves dominated by this tool that, you know, it's an amazing piece of technology that's, you know, got all of humanity's knowledge right at your fingertips, yet it's a terrible master if you let it be, right?
Yeah,
You get it out of your bedroom at night, and these things just it pervades.
Yeah. What about the investment in it? Because they've been pouring billions into this, haven't they? Yeah. And you'd expect some sort of result. Obviously, it's not being spent in the way it needs to be spent. So can you map out quickly how, do you have any sort of vision of how, if the money's there?
In health and mental health?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the moment, we spend $28 billion of our taxpayer money on the broader health budget. Now, just to be clear, virtually all of that is sickness, which is good if you're sick. I think the part that we don't spend money on is that it's a complete no-brainer from a sort of centrist argument to not get sick in the first place. And, you know, we actually used to invest quite a lot in this country in that. Across left or right, it didn't really matter. We kept going. A good example is New Zealand used to be the most active country in the OECD. So we had the best exercise, the best activity, the best health related to that. 20 years on from that, we're in the bottom third. And everyone else got the same technology at the same time as us. So, you know, something else changed here.
Oh, we're early adopters, Grant.
We were early adopters of being lazy. But you can invest in that. And we used to actually, believe it or not, I'm not arguing for more government control, but we actually used to have a Ministry of Health that had actual resources and, you know, world-class leadership in there. And we actually had, this was back when we had the Hillary Commission and then I think called Spark, which didn't do high-performance sport. They were actually pretty functional in that space. And that's one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons we were amongst the most active group of the world. So you'd invest in these things. If you put 20% of your health budget into the prevention as end, prevention as cure, we would do so much better as a society. The only question is, where do you got to take the money away from other people who are sick? And that's pretty brutal, right? Personally, I would take it from the fact that 40% of our health budget goes in the last 6 months of people's life for mostly care that they didn't ask for, that makes no difference to the quality or quantity of life. But I don't want to be the politician that does that, and I won't be, and I doubt there will be one that's got the guts to do that.
Yeah, we had a couple of folk on here a week or two ago talking about an idea that actually brought over from the UK called the Forest School. And, a part of that, the idea of that was to, you know, get children out in the environment. And obviously, if they're going to be building dams on rivers, boy, I wanted to go along once I heard that. But once they're building dams on rivers and doing things, they're exercising like crazy, and they're getting a spatial kind of feel. And it struck me, and we had feedback too from people who were really enthusiastic about that after hearing about it, that, you know, those things could be added into school life of New Zealand as, you know, a default part of it quite easily. Yet, you know, it's only available for a very small number of kids. You've got to have money to access it. Yet the results are really cool. So are those the sorts of, I'm just using that by way of an example, are those the sorts of things, you know, simple things that can be done?
Yeah, I really like those schools, by the way. And I think you need to include things like lighting fires in there, cooking on an open flame. Yep. Knives and saws and things like that as well, used in a way that you can understand. I mean, just to illustrate this, we did a study now 15 years ago where we just went into schools and convinced some of them to remove all the rules in the playground, and they had bull rush and they stopped mowing parts of the school lawn. And
bull rush used to be the highlight of our day.
Yeah. And we got good improvements in learning and activity and overall health, and actually reduced injuries in the school, reduced bullying. It was cool. And also, you think of bull rush as being dangerous, But when you actually observe the kids doing it, they've got all sorts of rules. It's like, well, you know, Paul's pretty quick, so he can tackle Grant, but he's got a, Paul's also got a sore hip, so we have to use one hand on it. You know, like they adjust.
Yeah, they sort it out. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. They adjust for that. So.
And it's even good to have them doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Tree climbing, you know, fire building, all these things, just bring them back to school. Good idea.
Okay, yeah, because that's ground level, right?
Yeah.
And no devices in the wilderness.
Yeah. No, and also, actually, that cell phone ban's an interesting thing because it's like the first Norwegian data's come out on that, and it actually has already reduced mental health demand in Norwegian schools, particularly for girls. So, you know, there's some evidence that that's actually doing something.
Why is it girls that suffer more? Is that the word?
I think, my hypothesis on that, I think girls are more prone to rumination, living into in the past and the future, and social media is so pervasive for that. You know, boys' poor mental health is probably just, you know, a lack of physicality, and I think they tend not to ruminate so much, or that's a pretty broad generalization.
Is that what Mike King talks about? I've heard him talking about I've chatted to him about it, the inner critic that keeps cycling through endlessly, and many kids can't get off of that, you know?
And that might be seen to be more of a thing for girls than boys, but again, it happens in both.
All right. Anything more to say about that, Grant? Any more pearls of wisdom?
No, I mean, you know, like there's a role in society, in your own health, your children and family's health and society's health to have your say. And I just encourage people to be a bit more fearless about that. Well, not fearless, actually, bravery. So bravery is carrying on and saying stuff, saying the right thing anyway, even if you're scared. Even if you've got some fear, like that's a really, really important thing in a social democracy. And last time I looked, we were still a social democracy. So making sure you have your say, you know, you can write to your MP, you can write to the Prime Minister, you can write to the Minister of Mental Health, you can write to the principal of your school, you can write to the school board, you can write to your community thing. You can, you know, these might seem like fruitless and meaningless things, but in a social democracy, they're still important.
All right. So any talk of mental health strategy going forward that doesn't involve a kind of reinvention is just same old, same old? Can we?
Yeah. Well, I can't imagine if we do the same stuff, we're not just going to get worse. Yeah. Because, you know, counselling will help a few people who have got some troubles. But we couldn't, A, keep up with it, and B, it's not the cause in the first place. If it's not the cause, like, what are you doing? It's a little bit like, you know, you've got your car and it's got the oil light on, and the solution is to get a bit of black insulation tape and stick it over it.
Cover it over, yeah. It's all right now.
Yeah.
That's like E for enough on the gas tank. Yeah. All right. Well, that's really interesting. I got one more thing I want to ask you about, given your position and you'll have knowledge on this. The vibe in academia right now at the moment, Grant, is it easing up? Is it still stifled, censorious? Where is it at?
Yeah, I think the general free speech stuff's improved quite a lot. I mean, it's not anyway there. That's definitely improved. So I don't particularly have any fear or anyone around me about saying what I think's important. And I think there was a time, especially in COVID, that was a thing. The race level stuff, I think it's, and the gender stuff, I think, yeah, you probably want to be pretty careful in academia about raising those as issues because you get your head chopped off pretty quick. So, yeah, those are still the taboo places. And but, you know, and more general in your lane, in the scientific lane, especially medicine, I think it's back to being more of a free-for-all, which is a good return.
All right, great to have you back on. Grant Schofield, Professor Grant Schofield, Professor of Behavioural Nutrition and Physical Activity at AUT. You're welcome anytime, Grant.
Thanks, Paul. Catch ya.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.